I'm Dime Lobaubert, stage and studio on Arts Watch. We're on location right now at the 2110 Theater in Portland. And with me is playwright Sue Mock. Hello, Sue.
Hi, Dime.
And director Gemma Whelan. Hello, Gemma.
Hi, Dime.
So nice to see both of you. So you're both working on Sue's newest play, Madonna of the Cat. It's a play that explores friendship, motherhood, and forgiveness, and also maybe answer some questions, maybe, we'll find out, about the missing years for Hermione and Paulina in Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. The show runs November 1st through the 23rd at 2010 Theater in Portland. And Sue, I just want to give a little bit of background bio. Sue Mock's plays include Monograms, The Shadow Testament, A Noble Failure, The Yellow Paper, and The Lost Boy, which received the Oregon Book Award, and The Difficult Season, a collaboration with renowned jazz musician Dave Frischberg. And she's received fellowships and grants from Oregon Literary Arts, the Oregon Arts Commission, and Oregon Humanities. And she retired from Clackamas Community College, where she had been teaching for 28 years. And Gemma Whelan is, of course, the founder and former artistic director of Corrib Theater, as well as a director, novelist, screenwriter, and educator. And she's directed all over Portland, including Artist Repertory, Profile, Milagro, Coho, Boom Arts, and Portland Center Stage's Jaw Festival. So welcome, both of you, to Stage and Studio. It has been quite a while.
It has. Yes. Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, it's really nice to see that you're both working together on Sue's new play. And Sue, we go back a long ways.
We certainly do.
We were both like a handful of female playwrights back in the day, back in the 90s, yes, right? The early 90s. And you at the time were when we first got together, was working on Monograms. Mm-hmm. And I was working on Breaking Glass, yep, at Portland Rep.
Yep, I remember that. And we hung out a little bit and talked about being women playwrights in Portland back then.
Back then, I know, when there wasn't like a group,
yeah,
of us.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, yeah.
So how does the time fly, dear?
How does the time? You have a child, that's one thing. Yeah, and it goes, it just goes, you know, Gemma, it just goes. You're working, you're writing, you're living, and here we are.
Well, and it's great to see that you're still writing, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Has your writing process changed from that first time in the early days to what you are doing now?
Yes. In the early days, I wrote frantically all the time. I'm just all the time. I was idea. It was everything. And then when I started working full time and raising a child, it becomes different. You squeeze in the hours when you can. You get a sabbatical, and then that's great. And now, being retired, I have all this free time again. It's different. Everything has slowed down, and I don't feel the need to be as, you know, producing all the time. It's like, if it's here, it's here. If it's not here, I'll go out in the garden.
I love that you say that, because in the early days, I was writing all the time, and I have all these unfinished plays, yeah, you know? Mm-hmm. I go, oh, I'll get back to it someday, and I never did, you know, kind of thing. But I'm wondering, do you feel like, because you've done it for so long, that if somebody asked you to sit down and write a play, you could just do it? Because I feel like I could if somebody like commissioned.
Absolutely. Yes. Please do. I will. Yeah, I do. I feel like I could do it. And I feel like, I guess the thing I'm more confident than I was in my younger days is about structure. I understand. I've taught it for so long. I understand how to play with structure, how to work with structure, how to get to a certain place. I think that comes, it's just like, you know, when musicians practice, it just, the scales become easier, the ways you move your fingers become easier. I feel like that part of it has become somewhat easier for me. It's never easy, but somewhat easier, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense, because you have the discipline too, that you can sit down and do that, you know. And I wish that there was more of that kind of opportunity for veteran female playwrights, you know, because you do know, it's not like you, the early days where you're just learning and you keep writing and writing, and now you have, you know, precious time.
Yeah, exactly. And that feels good. Like I said, it's still never easy. It's still, it just is. And also, I feel like as I've gotten older, one of the things I've learned when you get into rehearsal, right, playwriting's so different because if you're a novelist, as Gemma knows, has done, it's a solitary experience. You work with an editor and they give you feedback and you go, okay. And then you go back and you, when you're working, when you're playing to a cast of actors and they're trying to figure out, they've got a job to do. And if your play is missing some, there are some holes in the boat, as it were, and they can't get to where they need to go. That's a very, you have to kind of fix in public in a way or in a group of people. And you're like, okay, I'll get back to you. Hang on. And I don't, as long as people are doing their jobs and they're professional, I don't take any of that personally at all. It's all about the story. And you just go, all right, the story needs to be told better and I can go back and fix it. You know, and I feel better about that as I get older too.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that process when we start talking about Madonna of the Cat. Where does that title come from, Sue?
It comes from a painting by a Renaissance artist, Giulio Romano. And Giulio Romano is the only actual artist that Shakespeare ever called out directly in a play. And so at the end of Winter's Tale, when Hermione is this statue, right? And and Paulina says, I'm going to present this statue by, and she calls out an artist, Giulio Romano. And so as I was writing the play, I was like, who is this Giulio Romano and why did, and I can talk about more about who Giulio Romano is later, but he did several Madonna and Child paintings, among other things. And one of the paintings he created was called Madonna the Cat, and it features prominently in the play.
It's Giulia?
Giulio.
Okay, because I thought, Giulio, it's a woman.
Romano. But yeah, no. Yeah, Giulio Romano. Yeah.
So that's fascinating. I want to talk about this. I love writers who tackle the missing years of famous books and famous plays. And I'm thinking like Wide Sargasso Sea, which was the missing years of Rochester before he met Jane Eyre. Or Mary Riley, who's the Dr. Jekyll's housemaid, you know. There's also March that I read about that is the backstory of Mr. March from Little Women. So
yeah.
Does that fascinate you too?
Yes, absolutely. And this play, in Winter's Tale, what I love about is this play is about transformation, both literal transformation and figurative transformation, and forgiveness. And at the end of the play, Hermione, you know, there's this great reconciliation scene, and we're to believe that Leontes and Hermione, there's forgiveness. And I'm curious, because of the horrible things he has done to her, how does a person reach that place? And so the play really explores that.
Yeah. Winter's Tale is one of my favorite Shakespeare plays, but the time jump between the two halves, you know, the winter versus the spring. Yep. And this resurrection of Hermione, it's never explained, and you think it's magic or whatever. So what made you want to pursue the missing years of Hermione and Paulina?
Well, it's a story about friendship, and that Paulina really is the person who orchestrates, and we talk about this, Gemma talks about it a lot in rehearsal, who orchestrates this whole thing. And it was in the pandemic when I wrote it too. So this, you know, we're all in isolation and imagining this woman in isolation. It was really hard, that part of the play. Like there's two halves of the play. There's the Paulina, Hermione in the room section of the play. And then there's these characters that I made up, which is the shepherd woman. Her name is Donna, who is raising Perdita. And then I made, you know, Winter's Tale has Shakespeare's most famous stage direction, Exit Pursued by a Bear. And so the bear is a character in this play. And that kind of goes back and forth between the two worlds. So, yes. And so the parts where I could imagine or, you know, just make stuff up. And those parts came easier than you're like, well, okay, I'm writing a person in isolation. What does a person do on stage when you're in isolation? And I finally came with she imagines a lot of things. And there's a series of her writing letters to Perdita as time goes by. And then among other things, like how she uses her imagination to, you know, be in this place.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the bear, because to me that is a big signal that, yeah, this is probably a comedy, you know?
It's not a comedy, but it's not there are some moments that are pretty funny. I mean, the actors, like I said, we've got a really good cast. But in the end, and yeah, and it ends. Another thing I was interested in, this is a shift here, but another thing that I was interested in exploring is how people sacrifice for each other. You know, like to get to a place of forgiveness, to get to a place where the social order returns. Like, I mean, we're in a time of great upheaval right now. To get to a place of a social order that is, you know, an ethical, just social order, certain people have to sacrifice, right? And it's often the people who were the most victimized by the disorder and moral decay of the previous world. And so the person in this particular play, Paulina, makes a great sacrifice to keep the secret. Hermione makes a great sacrifice to wait. Donna, who raises these people who are these selfless people who give of themselves, you know, for the good of others to restore a broken system and society. And then, you know, and it's all about this Perdita, the lost child, who is the next generation. So that's one of the, you know, that theme is constantly in my mind. I mean, we see so many things, you know, we love the anti-hero, right? We love to see how flawed, and definitely characters are definitely flawed in this play, but flawed people doing really horrible things to each other. I'm like, what about people who really sacrifice simply for somebody else because they know it's the right thing to do? So that's at the heart of this too.
Gemma, I want to talk to you about what made you want to work on this play and this collaboration with Sue.
Well, I've known of Sue's work for a long time and have seen a lot of it. So many of her wonderful shows were produced at Artist Rep and many other places. And we've been meeting, you know, around town for years. And then we just happened to connect regarding this play. But I was intrigued by the idea immediately. I was intrigued by the name. I was intrigued by the fact that it actually, Madonna of the Cat, was an actual work of art. And the Shakespeare had referred to the artist. And I, too, love the idea of what these big spaces that sometimes, you know, appear in works in literature and what happened. And then Shakespeare's play doesn't say anything about that, really. And I think, I mean, I would say Hermione's extremely shortchanged in Shakespeare. And I think Sue has remedied that in this play. And I love the fact it seems like a gift to the women that she has created this space for magical things to they're ordinary things. I mean, they're magical, but not supernatural magical. They're internal changes that need to happen. And, you know, 16 years is a long time. It's not surprising to me that Sue started this during the pandemic when we were all locked in. And in this case, Hermione and Paulina developed this. They already had a connection, but it's a new and much closer connection that they develop with a huge amount of sacrifice and inside the confines of a very small room. And on stage, it actually is literally a very small room. Also, it's almost like a cell. So I see it as an incubation period in a way. That word keeps coming up for me in rehearsal is like it's an incubator. And all of these things are getting cooked up in here. It's also really hard to like stay there and not want to get out. Of course, people want to get out. And then there are things about the play. When I read it first, one of my first thoughts was Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett, mm-hmm. which is about people waiting for, in this case, something that never shows up or someone who never shows up. But tomorrow they're going to go back again and they will wait again. So what do you do while you're waiting? And, you know, Sue addresses that problem and that question is, what do you do to fill up 16 years? And then on the other hand, there's a counterpoint of this very delightful young girl who we actually see her. We hear her when she's like zero, meaning like a few months. We hear her crying, you know, and she's a baby and discovered by this other made-up character, Donna, who's a mother figure. And it becomes her mother, her de facto mother. But we see her at 5. We see her at 6 and 7. We see her at 10. We see her at 16 before she comes back. So, you know, that's another sort of incubator. And the people who are taking care of her, Donna, knows that it's borrowed time, really, with this wonderful child who has something very special in her. She doesn't know, nobody really knows the origins. They have an idea because they know where the baby came from. But also there's a choice, I think, that they make is like, well, I'm not going to ask any questions about that. Partly because it's kind of dangerous what they did. It's dangerous that they took in this, they know it's a royal child and it ended on their doorstep.
Yeah, I just think it's ridiculous that they had to wait 16 years for this guy to cool down, you know, the king to finally be receptive to forgiveness, right?
It's a long time. It's a long time. And Sue, you know, tracks that. It's one of the things that, I mean, that she meets out in the play, as it were, in terms of how Leontes, because we see him in the background, because Pauline is in the court. So she's in touch with him. So we see how he changes. But then Paulina makes decisions, too, about how long, you know, he waits or should he wait. But ultimately, also, they're beholden to an oracle by Apollo. So there is an overarching notion that Apollo has the oracle. It's there. Leontes is a jealous tyrant. Hermione is chaste. And Leontes will not have an heir until that which is lost, which is Perdita, is found. So we have to wait out. And there is a sense of the women grapple with this too, because that's faith and hope and holding on to this belief, letting go of it at times too, because they're human, but ultimately staying the course for 16 years. And then she does, you know, she does come back. Spoiler.
Well, if you know The Winter's Tale, you know she does come back, so it's not that much of a spoiler.
I'm joking.
I know. But it does seem like, you know, I really like that it's from the female perspective. I think we need more of that regarding Shakespeare, frankly, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also women having choice, you know, having agency, which sometimes they don't get really in a lot of Shakespeare's plays. And I am a big lover of Shakespeare and he's amazing. He's not a bad playwright either.
Not a bad playwright.
Not bad.
Okay. Yeah.
Not bad.
He'll do.
I'll keep taking him. He's good.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, Sue, you alluded to that when you have a playwright in residence, it's tempting to work on scenes and work on individual lines and make some changes. Has there been much of that? I know you're early on in the process here.
Yes. The first week, there were quite a bit of changes. And they were good changes. I mean, I think, and again, they were in the Paulina Hermione scenes mostly. Because, and I think one of the characters that I hadn't really tracked was Paulina. And I've done, you know, and that became apparent as we were working through some scenes that there were just, as I said, some holes in the boat. And I think we filled a good deal of those. So that feels pretty good.
You felt it was just fine to be able to make those suggestions.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's nothing like an actor getting into the role. They're the ones who actually have to feel this, you know, in their bodies. And once they say the words come out of their mouths. So, and they're the ones, you know, neither myself nor Sue will be on stage when the show opens. We're gone, you know. I mean, we're not gone, but we don't have, well, our bodies are not up there.
Right.
So the actors are the ones who have to embody them. So actually, we have an amazing group of actors. So
they ask a lot of questions.
They ask a lot.
Yeah.
They challenge. Does this work?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the changes were, they definitely have strengthened the play. There's absolutely no question about that.
Yeah.
And in terms of the arc or the through line for Paulina, she's become even, I mean, I think she was a force, but there were just some things that needed to be strengthened in order to trace the through line of how she grows and how she gets stronger and stronger and, as you said, orchestrates this whole thing. And, of course, you know, she's the one in the end of The Winter's Tale who says, oh, by, you know, there's this amazing monument by this famous artist. And then unveils the statue as if, and in a way, she is the creator. She is the creator because it's actually Hermione. But in a way, the Hermione who appears at the end of Madonna of the Cat is one that has been molded in a different way than she would have been if she was just like stuck in the attic, you know, without Pauline's presence.
Well, you have some great actors working on the show, like Crystal Muñez, right? And Louisa Sermol, and some great designers that I got to work with, like set designer Alex Meyer.
She's amazing.
I know, she is. And sound projections designer Lawrence Ulagi. Oh, are you not doing projections?
We're not. No. We cut the projections, and we cut them, you know, with Lawrence there in a designer meeting where it became clear that we didn't need them. The things that we had initially, you know, you dream up when you're just brainstorming with designers, and Sue was in on all of the meetings, like this could happen, that could happen. Wouldn't it be cool if? And then sometimes when it comes to the actuality, you think, well, that's overkill, or it's not necessary, or it's not right in this world. So there were ideas that we had that it's going to be more analog. It's going to be more.
when Alex came with her design, that was it. I mean, and she's amazing. She had this.
She creates models. I love
she has
that.
These little models. And her idea was, well, she came with these photographs of miniatures as if, you know, just a bunch of miniatures. And she had this idea of creating a miniature space.
A tiny room.
And it's up 2 feet. And it was like, oh, that's perfect. and I, you know, because I agonized for so long. How are we going to do this in this tiny space? Yeah, we both had like, how are we going to do this? Up at night. I don't know how we're going to.
Yeah.
I mean, even, and she's so, I mean, you've worked with her before. She's so just, you know, nonchalant and cool and in delivering these brilliant ideas. Like there's a one point where the roof leaks in the room. And I'm like, oh, am I going to have to cut that? And she's like, oh, no, you just did it. And we'll make it happen. I was like it's
on
nothing.
A low budget.
On a low budget. Yeah.
So, she's amazing. Yeah. And I think that this space will be totally transformed, you know, which is something to look forward to. I felt like when I directed Johan and she was, I mean, she designed this. It looked like a, you know, in the Brunish of all things. And she made it into an actual living room. With the kitchenette that you wanted to live in, you know?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it was pretty amazing. So I told her it was like, you create another character with your designs, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. I wonder, you know, is there anything else you want to say about the production? And, you know, we're kind of early on right now. But as you're dreaming, as you're working on this, what are some of your goals and challenges, especially working in a smaller space like this?
We have a wonderful musical score. Stephanie Schneiderman, who's amazing, is writing the score. So, and we have Adam Fleming, who's a movement coach. We have some movement stuff that is, I mean, all that stuff we're still working through. But that is, it's just going to be a really, I don't want to sound, how do I say?
Like a sensory experience?
Sensory experience, yeah. Yes. And hopefully a visceral experience in a good way.
Now, when you say musical score, you mean like underscoring as opposed to singing?
Yeah, no. There's no breaking out in song. Well, there is some breaking out in song.
But there is some breaking out in song, and we also have beautiful singers in the show.
Yeah,
Luis is an amazing singer, and Emma,
Crystal,
who's playing Perdita. Yeah. Crystal doesn't get to sing. Maybe she needs to. We could have her join them in Bohemia for a little romp. And there's some dancing.
I think everybody should join you in Bohemia for a little romp.
Yeah, we have some waltzing.
We all need that right now.
It might even,
Bohemian Romp.
Exactly.
I think we should promote
Maybe that's the name of your next play, Bohemian Romp.
Anything else you want to say about the play?
Come and see it.
Yeah, of course.
I just want to say one of the big themes of the play, Madonna is in the title, and it's very much about parents and children or mothers and children. That's like a huge theme of different kinds of taking care of, different kinds of nurturing. And how unselfish that is.
Well, Madonna of the Cat by veteran playwright Sue Mock, directed by veteran director Gemma Whelan, opens November 1st and runs through the 23rd at 2110 Theater. There are two Pay What You Will previews on October 30th and 31st if you want to do something different for Halloween. And you can get tickets at 2110.org. And I have all that info at stageandstudio.org or orartswatch.org. So in the time remaining, did you want to say something else?
I just want to add that their copies of the play will also be available because my company, Shangana Press, myself and Adam Liberman, we're publishing Sue's play to be ready for the opening. So
that's been.
Remember the days of Rain City Publishing,
Rain City Press in Seattle.
Yeah, it's nice to have the bounded plays again,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah,
I just thought it was so cool. You know, it happens in Ireland a lot more so than I've seen it here. Where you go, it happens at the Abbey Theatre, and you go, and I love buying the play myself.
You got to start doing more of that, Gemma. Yeah.
Maybe it'll become a thing.
Survive this one.
Survive this one.
I just did
one.
A final proof of it, like right before I came here.
It's a lot because in addition to rehearsing, going back every night and putting the new rewrites into the script that's going to be published, and Adam's been working really hard, and yeah, it's
the one thing about publishing is like it's published and you can't make changes anymore, right?
Well, you know what, these days you can actually because you know it's published on demand. We're publishing it through Ingram, which is
I've done that,
but it is published on demand, so future editions changes could be made.
Yeah,
well, I think people do buy those books, you know, when they come to see the show. But in the time remaining, I just wanted to talk a little bit about working in the theater at a certain age when you're a female. And, you know, for me, it seems like there's fewer and fewer opportunities as you grow older for women. And it's not just about acting, it's about everything in theater. You know, there's fewer opportunities. And I'm wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about that and what it's been like for you. And, you know, because there's a certain adjustment you have to make, right? You want to take that on?
Do I want to take that on? Well, I've noticed it's weird. Like you can feel the drop off. And I don't know if you felt that in like grant writing. If I write and I put like dates on my resume, I'm not going to get funded. And I did that deliberately where I'm like, oh, I'm just going to take all the dates off my resume. And it made a difference. And I'm like, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to do that.
And I don't know if it's something, you know, Portland can have a very young vibe. And there's a lot of wonderful work by young, very young people who are starting out, which we need. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we need both. We need both. So I did that a long time ago. I took the dates off my resume. You know, it's really terrible that you have to do that in a way.
Yeah. I just feel like that's your whole track record. Yeah. Why aren't you impressed by that?
Exactly. That's what I thought. I see how long I've been around. And that's just it. And that's the frustrating thing, I think, with not just writers, actors, directors. Yeah. There's a wisdom that comes with experience. What we talked about at the beginning of this interview, it's like you start off, and there, when you're young, like that, like you said, Gemma, that the energy and the innovation of youth, but the wisdom of age is something that, you know, I think, yeah, I don't know. I sound cliche just saying it because people say it all the time. It's like, we feel like, oh, I've gotten older. I feel like I have more to offer. I feel like I'm a little more grounded, but I don't get the chance to try it. And so that's why I'm so thankful that, you know, Ted has said yes in 2110, that Gemma said yes, and we get to do this. And the actors in the show are older actors, 3 of the 5. Mm-hmm. So it's a, you know, it's a pretty seasoned crew.
Well, maybe that's the beginning of an older, you know, female-driven company, Gemma.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so.
Yeah, I know. Brooke Topman started 100 Lives, so she's doing it. And and that's the other thing. When the doors close for you, you just start, you know,
You make your opportunities
yourself, and that's kind of what we're all doing now.
Well, that's been my experience. Just produce it yourself, no matter, or publish it yourself, right?
You know, I founded my own company when I founded Karev 12 years ago because I came from the Bay Area and nobody knew me here. So it's very hard to work up when you come sort of mid career, especially.
Leads to my next question: was it you passed it on? I have a similar experience with starting Theater Diaspora, you know. Mm-hmm. Is it difficult? What was it like? What was that transition like? Because I'm still kind of having a, you know, just a pang every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I passed it on. It was coming out of the pandemic and I had, you know, personal reasons because of family. And there was something about the 10-year mark coming up that I thought I was just ready for a change. And I felt it was a good time to pass it on. So I'm very happy, actually, I've passed it on because I really don't want anymore the entire weight of, you know, producing, the raising the money and all of that. So I was hoping to leave that behind, but ended up, you know, co-producing in some ways, or we pitched in a lot in terms of for this production, myself and Sue and others.
Well, Gemma's done a lot of fundraising for this.
I don't mind that for
every once in a while. Yeah. But you're right. Yeah. The stress of it every year, right?
It's really stressful. It's really stressful. So I'm very happy to, I mean, there definitely are pangs, but I don't have regrets. And I see it going on to become a different company. And that's okay. That's good.
That's the hard part. It becomes something different. I know you have no control over it, so you have to let it go. But Sue, you get a lot of older playwrights, older female playwrights still working, right? What advice do you have for them? Because a lot of times, I like to ask playwrights for advice, and usually it's for like young people on what they should do. But really, for people who are veterans who want to keep pursuing their work, what do you think?
I'd say find your community. That's been key to me. I have a community of really good friends that I get an idea and I want to write something up and I can invite them to my living room. And then we figure out, like I'm working with Susanna Mars right now on a project we want to do coming up down the road. And it was just something that I had an idea that I was talking to her about it. And then she had another sort of twist on this idea. And we've started, we've written a draft. Like we went away and then it's just like, find your people, find the people you want to work with and start there. And then and sort of what you were saying earlier is that we're in a bit of a DIY situation. And that's challenging, but not impossible.
I feel like I've always been in a DIY situation.
Exactly. I
wouldn't have a career if I didn't make it happen, So when you brought up Susanna, I don't know if you saw Matilda. Susanna amazes me as an actress. She's running upstairs and running down, and she's singing full voice. I don't know how she does it. I really don't.
She's a force.
I need to catch up with Susanna sometime too. But that's great. You're doing something. So keep me posted on that. So any final thoughts?
I just want to say thank you, Dima, because you have been.
I'm not going to put that.
You've been supporting writers, theater makers for years and years and years. And you've been unwavering in that. And that's so important. And I just want to say thank you.
Well, I really appreciate you too, Sue, because anytime, I want to talk over something or need something, I know it's been years since that happened, but during the whole process of us working, you've always been very supportive.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that.
I'm here.
Yeah.
We'll stick together.
Add my thanks to that. I mean, you are an amazing supporter of the community. You need to keep this in, Dima.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
how do we get the word out? You help us to get the word out or else people don't know about it.
Yeah.
But thank you.
I like behind the scenes stuff. Don't you? Mm-hmm. Don't you want to, hear about that? Mm-hmm. Because we talk a lot about, come see the show, but the work.
Yeah.
Yes.
The work that goes in there and the discipline and frankly, having female collaborators, you got to support that.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you feel like this as a writer, that's my favorite part. I like being in rehearsal and solving the puzzle. Like I could, the opening night, I want to disappear and not, but just the being in rehearsal and solving the problem solving problems. But, you're really creating this thing out of all the puzzle pieces on the floor. And that to me is the best part. And I'm enjoying doing it now, and I'm so glad I have the chance to do it.
I think as a writer, it's actually a playwright. That's the most important part.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then just add, it's sort of the same thing, solving the problem, but the collaboration.
Yeah.
Having such a team. It's the whole team. It's the whole team. It's the actors and the designers. And we're so lucky. I mean, we assembled them all.
We did.
We are, all of us
and
with the theater. But
it's like a Marvel movie. Yeah. Superheroes, you're assembled.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So setting up production meetings is a challenge because it's a lot of people to get in the same room.
Right.
But it's wonderful.
Yeah.
You have a great team. You have a great cast. And I look forward to seeing it. And break legs to both of you.
Thanks, Dima.
Thank you so much, Dima. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Sue Mock and Gemma Whelan. It's really been lovely to catch up with both of you because it's been a while. So break legs on Madonna of the Cat. And I have links to 2110 as well as this podcast at stageandstudio.org or orartswatch.org. That's it for Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. Till the next conversation, I'm Dima Lo Roberts.